A state judge upholds a law requiring parental notification when a minor seeks an abortion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Fairbanks North Star Borough aims to develop a natural gas utility company.
They're not driven by a bottom line of making money. The sole interest would be in bringing affordable energy to the citizens of the borough.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation.
The Anchorage Superior Court released a decision upholding Alaska's parental notification law yesterday. In the process, it also reversed itself on a controversial provision allowing doctors to be prosecuted for knowingly providing abortions to minors without the notification of at least one parent. The law was passed in 2010 through a ballot initiative, and Planned Parenthood sued, calling the law unconstitutional. Judge John Suddick did not agree and upheld the law because of a, quote, compelling state interest in promoting family involvement. But even though Suddick kept most of the law intact, he was critical of many of the state's arguments. He determined that parental involvement advances no compelling state interest in the health of minor women and that it didn't protect minors from illicit relationships. He also described the criminal and civil sanctions included in the law troubling. Under the parental notification law, a knowing violation could result in a 5-year jail term and a $1,000 fine for a doctor who provides an abortion to a minor without notice to her parents. Suddick called this draconian, but allowed this part of the law to go through after the state argued that the statute wouldn't be enforced. Suddick tossed out a different portion of the law that would open doctors up to civil penalties who violated one of the parental notification statutes without realizing it. Planned Parenthood has not yet decided whether it will appeal the decision. The Fairbanks City Council has granted utility power to the North Star Borough for creation of a natural gas distribution utility. The power transfer follows similar action by the City of North Pole last week. It's part of a plan being pushed by Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins and a group of assembly members to finance infrastructure needed to truck North Slope gas to Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, gas is a cheaper, cleaner fuel alternative for Fairbanks, but the project requires major investment.
A private company, Fairbanks Natural Gas, has been trying to realize a North Slope gas trucking project for years, but it's been unsuccessful at wooing state dollars to fund the most expensive component, an over $150 million gas liquefaction plant. A public utility is viewed as a way to leverage the state money and avoid taxes while contracting out operations to other entities. The power transfer ordinance was passed by the Fairbanks City Council Monday night. Councilmember Bernard Gatewood described a municipal utility as a way to facilitate action.
They're not driven by a bottom line of making money. The sole interest would be in bringing affordable energy to the citizens of the borough.
Many council members expressed concern a municipal utility might become more than a grant conduit, so the ordinance requires City and Regulatory Commission of Alaska approval before the utility can compete with private sector companies. Mayor Jerry Cleworth said the idea of competition worries him.
You know, the idea was to create this utility so that we have a financing mechanism to take advantage of low-interest loans that might come our way, grants, those sort of things. A step beyond that would be to be a joint partner. I could see possibly doing something like that. There may be an opportunity that arises. But when we get to operating a utility, I start to get cold feet.
There's also concern about the borough sapping away money from mega state grants. An amendment offered by Councilmember Vivian Stiver reduced administrative fees the borough or utility could charge to state grants from 2.5% to 1% of the total.
I think when it comes to energy and our need for that money, I think every dime needs to go to the ratepayers' benefit. I really feel strongly about that.
Stiver said the limitation is important because the utility will be seeking hundreds of millions of dollars in grants. An amendment put forth by Councilmember John Eberhardt addressed who can be employed by or serve on the board of the utility.
No local elected municipal official may be directly or indirectly employed by the utility in any paid position or nominated, elected, or appointed to the board if the board was created or the salary, compensation, or emoluments of the board were increased during the elected official's term of office.
The limitation would also apply to people involved in contracting companies that benefit from the utility. The council ultimately approved the power transfer ordinance with member Lloyd Hilling dissenting, saying he thinks gas can get to Fairbanks without government involvement.
It's worth a little more time to see if a private solution comes forth. Not to see if. It will come forth. It's going to happen, with or without state subsidy.
The Borough Assembly will consider an ordinance creating the municipal gas utility Thursday. A next step would be requesting support from the governor, who said he wants a united community front on a gas trucking plan. Other players that have to be brought in include Golden Valley Electric Association and Flint Hills Refinery, which are studying gas trucking. Fairbanks Natural Gas has spent millions to forward its project, and company president and CEO Dan Britton told the council the proposed municipal utility is starting to seem like a competitor.
If the intent is to facilitate and work together for the greatest benefit of the community, you know, I've been there for a long time, out in front of the legislature requesting funds for the North Slope plant and those things. So I was aligned with that idea many years ago, but we seem to be shifting from that in this ordinance.
Britton says his company's project can go without the help of a municipal gas utility if Golden Valley Electric signs on as an anchor tenant. Britton says he has upcoming meetings planned with Golden Valley and the governor to talk about the gas trucking plan. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich says he and other members of the Senate will try to move a fishery disaster relief bill after the election. As APRN's Peter Granis reports, time and money will be hard to find.
The Department of Commerce declared a fishery disaster last month for Alaska, Massachusetts, and six other states. Speaking on Talk of Alaska today, Senator Begich said he's working with the office of U.S. Senator John Kerry to move a disaster package through Congress.
Because there was a disaster declared in Massachusetts, or New England states, as well as in the Gulf on two other species, we have some allies on disaster relief money. And that's very important because usually we're hanging out by ourselves.
Begich would not say how much money the bill might be worth, so it is impossible to know how much aid fishermen in the YK region and Upper Cook Inlet could get. Congress will return to Washington, D.C. a week after the election, leaving little more than a month to move a bill. The real challenge will be getting the disaster bill on the schedule. Congress needs to pass a deficit reduction plan or face massive cuts to federal spending and tax increases January 2nd. So Senator Begich says he's hoping to tie the aid package to a larger bill.
It might be part of the farm bill when it gets finally resolved, because as you know, the farm bill passed the Senate, but it's over in the House right now, stalled, and maybe there's a way to kind of create a compromise and add a disaster piece on there.
Whether the aid comes with the farm bill or an appropriations bill, many think it has a greater chance of passing if it's tied to drought relief for the lower 48. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, defining the importance of language.
The reason why we like to speak Thlinkit, it saves our souls.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Pacific University offers convenient, high-quality, affordable adult undergraduate programs. Applications are due October 19th. Apply at alaskapacific.edu or by calling 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU.
A human skull was found near Wrangell over the weekend. As KSTK's Ariel Van Cleve explains, it appears to be very old.
Vina Stowe was out moose hunting and trout fishing with her parents and boyfriend Friday afternoon off Government Slough. Then she spotted something.
I'm always looking around and just looked down and was looking at this thing that looked like kind of like a cottonwood that was waterlogged with full of tannins. And I looked at it again and looked up at my boyfriend and I was like, Seth, I'm pretty sure that's a human skull.
The spot is about 5 miles to the north of Wrangell's city center. Stowe found the top half of the skull upside down in the slough. She says she's surprised she found it in the first place since it was likely underwater just a few days before she arrived because of the river level.
At first, you know, it's kind of slightly creepy, but then you think about it, it's like, wow, I mean, even if he's only 50 to 100 years, you know, laying there, like, what was he doing? It's kind of intriguing that it's there, and it's slightly kind of almost disturbing. Like, I was fishing, and I just stopped for a second and be like, oh my gosh, like, I found a human skull.
She says she immediately took pictures of the location and took a closer look at the skull itself. Stowe has taken anthropology courses in the past in preparation for a career in fisheries management.
It was kind of one of those things where, how old is it? Is it a skull that had just absorbed the tannins and is that brown color? Or is it actually, you know, really old? But the brow line was, the ridge is like very prominent, and the bones on the side of the eye sockets were really pointy. And I'm like, well, that's just very different characteristic for skulls. And I thought about my anthropology teacher and was like, I bet she'd be interested in this.
Stowe says she brought the skull back to the cabin where she was staying and called the police to let them know she would bring it in. She says she made sure to explain it was a very old skull. Stowe also sent pictures to her anthropology teacher, who pointed out the size and features could mean it belonged to an Alaska native. She says that's of special interest to her since she's Tlingit. The U.S. Forest Service took the skull from police and will have its anthropologist investigate and carbon date it. The agency has strict rules for handling of native remains. In Wrangell, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
The International Federation of Sled Dog Sports, or IFSS, has canceled the long-distance world championship race scheduled to take place in March. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
IFSS was hoping to make use of a 200-mile race course maintained by the Two Rivers Dog Mushers Association, but after a dispute between the two groups over race rules and a list of banned substances, the Dog Mushers Association opted to sever ties with IFSS. As a result, IFSS canceled the race. IFSS officials did not return phone calls for comment. It's unclear if the organization was unable to host the event on its own. Other world championship events will continue as planned. The Two Rivers 200 will also continue as planned. In a press release, IFSS said they're working with the International Sled Dog Veterinary Medical Association. It's unclear whether IFSS plans to change race rules or anti-doping regulations. The 2013 IFSS World Championship is hosted by the North Pole Economic Development Corporation. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
This week, we're bringing you the first in a new reporting series from the producers of Kids These Days. In 12 reports from across the state, they're asking the question, what's it like to be young in rural Alaska? Today, Sarah Gonzalez in Cake and Ann Hillman in Barrow find out why teaching Indigenous language to children is so important. We start with Sarah.
Efforts to teach Alaska Native languages to kids aren't exactly new in Alaska. In many areas, it's been done in some form or another for several decades. But in some places across the state, there is a new sense of urgency. As elders pass away, there are fewer fluent speakers, and more, the link between speaking the language, feeling connected to culture, and overall wellness is being understood.
So schools that have for years taught some Inupiaq or Tlingit are stepping up their efforts and trying new methods.
Tell you what.
Barrow Middle School language teacher Beverly Hugo sits with a student showing her cards with what look like random tally marks on them. She's helping the girl learn to identify and say Inupiaq numerals. Instead of looking like typical Arabic numerals, they're a combination of diagonal lines. The number system is based on 20, the number of a person's fingers and toes.
Our culture has used the body as a counting numeral base. So 20 digits are Inupiaq. Inupiaq is a person. So Inupiaq is 20.
Hugo's Barrow Middle School class is part of the North Slope Borough's efforts to revitalize the Inupiaq language using a computer program called Viva. The students listen to words over the computer, then select the matching picture. When they get enough right, they practice saying them out loud with Hugo. She says the program's focus on listening and speaking is very different from how the language used to be taught.
The previous 30 years of the Inupiaq language program, a lot of the kids learned to read and write, but they weren't comprehending what they were reading and writing about.
Now, some of the students, like Vernon Lovahawk, are using the language for practical reasons, like whaling with his family.
So when you're out in the camp and out in the ice, do you use some of the Inupiaq words that you learned here?
Yes.
Like which ones?
Like if I see one like going down in the water, and if it was on the top, like if it's going up then back down.
About 1,200 miles south of here, students in Cake, Alaska are also learning their indigenous language, Tlingit.
In Fallon Mills' classroom in Cake, third grade students practice their numbers and recite the colors in Tlingit.
Sigwat Yakheti is brown, and Sigwat means hemlock bark. And
the children learn that each color is associated with something in the natural world. Gray is baby seagull, green is green rocks. They are being taught more than just words. They are also learning about their history, culture, and the environment. The number of people in Cake who can converse in Tlingit has shrunk from 70 speakers in 2000 to just 24 in 2012. So, about 2 years ago, with funding from the local tribal government, students in first through eighth grades started spending 30 minutes a day, every day, learning their language.
If they speak Tlingit back then, they would get in big trouble, and they would get sent home or whipped. So they didn't get to speak Tlingit back then, but now they're letting us speak it so we can pass it on to our children and stuff.
How they learn their language varies by age.
What are we going to play right now?
Heads up, seven up.
Yep. How does it go? What are the rules?
Have to put shut down, goosh up.
Yeah, shut down means head down. And
Fallon's first graders play games and sing songs like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and Tlingit. In Ruth Demert's older 7th and 8th grade class, the students are learning to introduce themselves, a native tradition that acknowledges tribe, clan, moiety, grandparents, and parents.
My name is Jacqueline Benham. My Tlingit name is Sao Ut.
Demert has been teaching Tlingit and Cake since 1974. In her decades of teaching, she has learned that helping kids to learn their language is ultimately about instilling confidence.
They're going grow through life, and I hope a lot of them go through culture, and they're not going to look like the rest of the world. And, you know, people will ask, well, what tribe or nationality are you? And you know anything of your language, and you know anything of your culture. I think it's real important for self-esteem.
While in Barrow, Pearl Brower, president of Ilisavik College, says it's all about understanding the nuances of culture.
A culture's language kind of enhues everything about that culture. When someone speaks in your own language, there's so many pieces to it. It's not just words. There's intonations. There's meanings that you don't get.
Alaska Native children in Barrow, Cake, and all over the state are learning their indigenous languages for reasons much larger than school credit.
Like knowing where they come from and developing a sense of belonging, a strong identity.
The ability to converse with elders and then teach a new generation.
To speak and understand while working on a whaling boat.
And as this first grader put it,
the reason why we like to speak Tlingit, it saves our souls.
Reporting from Barrow, I'm Ann Hillman.
And reporting from Cake, I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
More information about the series and links to the podcast are at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. According to the Alaska Energy Authority and its partners, an average of $5.7 billion is spent annually on energy in Alaska. October is Energy Awareness Month, and for tips on how to save, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
An anonymous complaint over what were called mildly racy photos in a calendar put out by a Delta Junction area nonprofit prompted an obscenity complaint that reached the highest level of the U.S. Army. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports from Delta.
The Delta Greeley Area Relay for Life Committee produced the calendar to raise money for the American Cancer Society. It features pictures of local women dressed up to resemble retro-style pinup girls and includes a photo of the Fort Greeley Missile Defense Unit commander's wife in her underwear. The images drew a complaint from an organization called Concerned Alaskans, which alleged the photos were obscene. Army officials weren't able to identify who sent the complaint, nor to contact Concerned Alaskans. KUAC also was unable to find or contact the organization. But because the complaint was emailed to Army Secretary John McHugh, an investigation was launched. Women involved in the calendar project say they were stunned to learn about the complaint and the Army's investigation.
I'm still baffled.
That's Patsy Ewing. She's a local businesswoman who's supporting the calendar project.
I think it's tasteful and I'm glad they did it.
She says she first heard about the complaint when a reporter with Army Times called her about it 3 weeks ago. A spokesman for the Army Space and Missile Defense Command and Army Forces Strategic Command, the higher headquarters for Fort Greeley's 49th Missile Battalion, says the three-star general who reviewed the complaint concluded the photos were, quote, racy but not obscene. Spokesman John Cummings says Lieutenant General Richard Formica added that the Army had no authority to investigate the complaint because the calendar project was the idea of a non-Army organization and intended to benefit that organization, Relay for Life. And Cummings says the wife of Greeley's Missile Defense Unit commander is a civilian who's not bound by Army regulations.
While we did look into some aspects, we did not look at her actions as a private citizen.
But Cummings says the investigation continues because of other allegations made in the complaint.
We initiated a commander's investigation as to whether or not others involved, other soldiers were involved, and was their conduct inappropriate.
Cummings declined to talk about those other allegations and wouldn't confirm that the investigation now is focusing on an allegation of an inappropriate relationship involving Army personnel. That so-called fraternization could be in violation of Army regulations. Ewing, the Delta businesswoman, says she was at first uncomfortable about publicity that might not reflect positively on the project, which she says was intended to celebrate women. Ewing says she started feeling better after the Army Times story came out, and soon thereafter, the calendars began selling so quickly that she had to order more.
Even though this was kind of a negative angle, it promoted the sales, and I'm happy for that.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
More cruise ship tourists visited Alaska this year than last, but some ports did better than others. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the season-end report.
Susan Hess is setting up a beer tent as part of the Sitka Chamber of Commerce season-end celebration. She's co-owner of the Baranoff Island Brewing Company. The business began in 2010, so it's still figuring out the tourism market. But Hess says it's been great.
We've had a really good year. Business is growing. More people that live in the community are bringing people out to the brewery when they come to visit. We're getting more cruise ship passengers. We're getting more independent travelers. And we definitely noticed a difference in the charter fishermen that are making their way out to the brewery as well.
Sitka expected to see about 110,000 passengers this season, about 20% fewer than last summer, and only about a third of the number of visitors 5 years ago. Rough weather also canceled its two final ships, shrinking the 2012 season even more. But statewide, the passenger count grew. Industry officials say about 940,000 people sailed Alaska waters this year. That's about a 6% increase from the previous season.
There were more ships brought back to Alaska, and some had longer itineraries, maybe another sailing either in the early spring or in the late fall, and some bigger ships as well.
John Binkley is president of the Alaska Cruise Association. He says the industry's uptick involved more than passenger numbers.
Different areas of Alaska are affected differently, but I would say just anecdotally and talking to people around the state that the spending was up as well. Not only more visitors to increase the overall amount of economic activity, but also the amount that each visitor spent, I think, was a little bit higher this year than last year.
Cruise ship traffic affects most of the state. Some ships sailing through Southeast go to South Central, where tourists move to buses, trains, or planes to take them to Rail Belt or other locations. And a couple ships sail as far as Kodiak, Homer, and Unalaska. More passengers increase business on shore, but there are other factors. In Southeast, the wet summer took its toll.
Anytime, you know, somebody's on vacation and it's pouring rain, some people take that as the cue.
Tyler Hickman is vice president of operations for Icy Strait Point. It's a renovated cannery and cruise ship attraction in Hoonah, west of Juneau.
It certainly impacts retail, food and beverage, and, you know, tours. The walk-up sales that you might normally get on that type of a day just don't appear.
Cruise lines set their schedules far in advance. Industry spokesman Binkley says the 2013 calendar increases capacity.
For next year, it's a combination of more ships, larger ships, and more sailings for the ships that are coming. So the combination of all that should push us right over the million passenger mark.
That's where it was about 5 years ago. The 2013 season begins in April when the Crystal Symphony sails from Japan to Dutch Harbor, Kodiak, and Ketchikan. By May, other ships will be cruising north from Vancouver, Seattle, and San Francisco. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ariel Van Cleve in Wrangell, Sarah Gonzalez in Cake, Ann Hillman in Barrow, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer. Alaska Pacific University offers convenient, high-quality, affordable adult undergraduate programs. Applications are due October 19th. Apply at alaskapacific.edu or by calling 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.